Earlier this summer, we flew into London's Heathrow Airport. Four of us, it was Stephanie and I, Oliver and Remy. We were picked up there at the airport by our friend Brian. He and his family live in Oxford. So Brian picked us up at the airport, drove us back to their place where it's a rather small apartment in Oxford where the five of them, Brian and Kim and their three children live. So there was nine of us there together. It was fairly cozy. Of course, with nine of us, we would need two cars to get around and take the day trips that we wanted to take. And Brian just said, you know, don't worry about it, no big deal, Jared, just rent a car when you get here. It won't be any problem. Just follow me around, you know, on all these trips. Be fine. Now, most of you at some point have played follow the leader. When you didn't know where you're going and you needed someone to lead the way, you just drove the car and somebody else knew where you're going. Your job was just to follow them. It sounds simple, right? I was a little anxious about all this driving in England. So for weeks before our trip, I imagined driving in England. Like I thought through, okay, what will it feel like to be driving on the other side of the road? And I imagine coming up to intersections, you know, thinking left side of the road, left. So if you're turning right, you're going to turn in the far side of the road. If you're turning left, you got to turn into the near lane. I was working through this, so I'd get used to it. But my imaginative European driving was faulty and inadequate on two very important fronts. First of all, I forgot that I would be driving from the right side of the car, or what we know as the passenger seat, which completely screws up everything. So I hadn't imagined that part. The second thing, is that I didn't realize that there really are very few intersections in England at all where the streets actually meet at right angles. Unfortunately, the English have fallen in love with the roundabout. So during that week we spent with our friends in Oxford, we took some great day trips, and you know, because when you stay with people who live there, you get to do things that you wouldn't manage on your own. So we took a day trip to the Tintern Abbey, it's beautiful ruins. We went to the picturesque villages in the Cotswolds in Wales. We went to the city of Bath, these wonderful Roman baths from the first century. We went to Shakespeare's hometown of Stratford, where we saw the play Julius Caesar by the Royal Shakespeare Company, saw his home church and all that stuff. And in all these day trips, the driving wasn't all that bad because all I had to do was just follow Brian. Now, I'm sure there was beautiful scenery, and I'm sure my wife and family enjoyed it along the way, but I saw none of the scenery or the rolling hills or the spectacular architecture on these drives, because the roads, the lanes, are so tiny and narrow that the oncoming traffic, which is on the wrong side of you, by the way, is passing you at about 6 inches. 6 inches on the other side of your car, there's either a stone wall or a tall hedge. There is no shoulder at all. There is no margin for error. So I'm white-knuckling it, bearing down, focused on just trying to keep the car in the middle of the lane. So I saw none of that. But those narrow roads were nothing compared to the nightmare of those English roundabouts. These roundabouts are everywhere, and the English enter them and fling through them at very high speeds. Now keep in mind, you enter these roundabouts at high speed going clockwise. It's very counterintuitive to go into them and go around them this way. Not only is the traffic moving fast and moving clockwise, there are no less than five or six different options for exits around this roundabout, all of which will fling you off in some particular direction. So we traveled with them that week, but on Thursday morning, our last day with them, we had made plans to go to Stonehenge, which is about an hour and a half southwest of Oxford. Their family had plans that day, couldn't join us, so it was going to be me driving with no one leading on this trip to Stonehenge. We did make it there okay with the help of GPS. We got there. I felt a great sense of accomplishment just getting there. It was dimmed a bit after, you know, just being there at Stonehenge. My success at getting there was dwarfed by the realization that these ancient druids had quarried tons of rock, hauled it for hundreds of miles across the terrain of England, built a cosmological observatory that still stands 5,000 years later. Nonetheless, I felt pretty good about getting there. The trip back to Oxford did not go quite as smoothly. We came to a particular roundabout on the way back, and the GPS instructed us before we headed into the roundabout to enter the roundabout and take the fourth exit. Now, there are always several lanes of traffic going into the roundabout, and it's crucially important that you get yourself in the correct lane so you can be flung out at the proper exit. You can't be in the outermost lane too early, or you'll get squeezed off before you want to. You can't get on the inside lane, or you get trapped and just keep going around in a circle. So you have to be in one of the middle lanes, but you need to be ready to shift into the outward lanes when you're coming up to your exit. And one other small fact, remember, there are dozens of other cars speeding into this roundabout from all the other on-ramps, trying to get in their own lane. So what happened was, I got pinched into the outer lane too soon. I couldn't get back in because of the speed of the traffic, and so we have flung off in the wrong direction, headed exactly back the direction we came. So as we exited the roundabout, the GPS says, you know, travel to 8 miles, enter the roundabout, you get out another exit and go back. So we had to drive for 8 miles in silence, you know, the wrong way, to enter a roundabout to try to get it right for the privilege of going back to the original roundabout to attack it again. Well, we finally made it home. But driving was much more difficult when I had to do it on my own than when I got to follow someone else. It was much easier when I just needed to follow Brian's lead. Our reading this morning is about following the leader. And Jesus calls us to follow him even when he leads us to places we'd rather not go. Our experience is much like the disciples' experience. We're attracted to Jesus. We're attracted to his love and to his wisdom, to his power to heal, to his gentleness and his mercy. And when he makes all this available to us as a new way of life, and when he invites us to repent and turn our lives in the direction of this newness, something deep inside of us calls out, yes, I want that. I want to move in that direction. We're tired of the way things work. We're tired of our own personal limitations and our failures. We're tired of how difficult life can be at points, how difficult it can be for us, but we know other people in our lives who have it more difficult than we do. For those who are poor, for those who live in violent places, for those who live under very difficult circumstances. Life shouldn't be like this, we protest. And so when Jesus invites us to be part of something new, we want that. We want to be part of something new. We want change. And perhaps we're gathered here as friends and members of this congregation because for us being here is an opportunity to practice that newness, a chance to be a part of real change, a part of something different. And so we gather here before we head out into our week because we want to be a group of people who center our lives around Jesus the Christ. We expect him to lead us to be the pioneer towards something new and different. So we gladly set off with him towards this new future, Jesus leading the way. And it's exactly at this point that Jesus begins to explain to his disciples and to all of us that where he is going will bring him into great suffering, that he will be killed before being raised to life 3 days later. And along with Peter, all of us shout at once, "Don't do it! Don't go that way! Don't head towards Jerusalem! Don't take this difficult path! Good grief, lead us somewhere else!" And Jesus cuts us off and says with firmness, "I'm the leader. You're the followers. Don't do this demonic thing where you try to get out in front of me and lead the way yourself. Don't pretend like you can control me. Get back behind me where you belong. I've told you where I'm going. Now I need you to follow the leader." When we hear the words of this gospel passage, it sounds rather unappealing at first glance. He calls us to self-denial, deny ourselves, to bearing our own cross. Why on earth would we sign up for this? It's a miracle that anyone's here today. Why would I want to follow Jesus if it will lead me towards pain and heartache and difficulty? I think Peter speaks for all of us when he protests going the way of hardship and suffering. Isn't there an easier path? Isn't there a more comfortable way, Jesus? Not really, he says to us. Not if you want a life that's connected to others in practices of care and affection. Not if you want some freedom from your own selfish energy that works day and night to avoid pain and suffering. We tend to hear Jesus call to discipleship as a sort of burden because we have become convinced that what will bring us the most satisfaction in life is individualized accomplishment and success. But Jesus is here today to offer us a different story. And that story says that we'll feel the greatest satisfaction, the greatest gladness, the deepest sense of purpose and meaning when we share our lives in life-giving connections with other people. I want you to hear this, and maybe this will help you hear the good news in this gospel reading. When Jesus calls us to self-denial and to cross-bearing, he is not asking us to go seek out more pain and suffering. That's not what's going on. That would be rather silly and would make you mentally off kilter if you were going to do that. Regular life is hard enough. And Jesus is not here to ask us to go out and actively find a few more ways to suffer. He's just asking us to receive and welcome the ordinary challenges, the ordinary difficulties that all of us face in our lives. When Jesus says that those who want to save their lives will lose it, and that those who willingly lose their lives for his sake will find it, it sounds tricky, but he's not trying to confuse us. He's only trying to help us see how strange it is how life really works. If we spend all of our energy trying to protect ourselves from harm, trying to secure our own happiness, we'll wind up losing much of what makes our lives beautiful and satisfying. And on the other hand, when we share what we have, when we gladly spend time with others who need help, when we slow down in our own routine so that we can really pay attention to what's going on around us, then we begin to find a life that's extraordinarily rich and meaningful. Jesus called it God's new kingdom. So don't hear the gospel story today as a command to go out and look for new forms of pain. Instead, hear it as an invitation to stop wasting your energy and your resources protecting yourself, securing yourself. Hear it as an invitation to let go of the stress of always needing to win, always having to appear like you have your act together. That's really tiring to live that way, but lots of us do it. It's a terrible burden if you feel the stress of always having to have it together. And when you receive this freedom that Jesus offers you, freedom to lose your life, you'll find a new life that has more of what you wanted anyway. The truth be told, we're already living as Jesus' disciples. And we're already bearing our own crosses and living in ways open to the needs of others. Let me give you just a few examples of this cross-bearing, and you'll recognize it in your own life. Some of us have dealt with cancer or with other really difficult health issues, physical issues, mental health issues. Some of us have lost loved ones dealing with grief over the past year or so. Some of us have battled depression and loneliness. Some of us have already restructured our lives so that we can share ourselves, our time, and our resources with people in great distress. That's cross-bearing. Some of us are confused and discouraged with the hatefulness and anger in our public conversations. Some of us have lost jobs or are working at jobs that we don't like and that we wish we could quit. Some of us have been through difficult periods in our marriage and our relationship. Some of us have been through a divorce and trying to figure out what's next. Some of us have been disappointed or betrayed by friends that we trusted. And some of us are in the middle of financial challenges where there's not enough to make ends meet and we're not sure how to see the way forward. Those are all crosses to bear, and you're already bearing them. So if you just open your life, open your heart, you will receive the good news that Jesus promises you today. You don't have to go out looking for more crosses to bear. You're already carrying yours, and God is the one who sustains you in this process. So the real question today is whether all these difficulties and challenges in life make us more self-absorbed and bitter, or whether, with God's help, they can make us more tender, more caring, and more available to other people. Maybe what we all need this morning as we head into the fall is some simple but powerful advice, like follow your leader. Do what the leader does. Let your life look like his life, open and available to the pain and the heartache of other people. Yes, Jesus was a first century Jewish male who lived a very long time ago in a faraway place when they didn't have fast food, retirement accounts, and Twitter. That's all true. And you could come up with other reasons, other excuses for not following him if you wanted. But his life was God's good news for you and for me and the whole world. He doesn't ask us to bear his cross. He did that. The good news today is that he only asks us to bear ours. Amen.